This is Polling Matters, and I'm Kieran Pedley. This week, we're doing things slightly differently. I'll be joined by Rob Vance, who's Vice President at the research and strategy firm Pensione & Berland. He's standing in for Leo while Leo's away in Africa, and I should stress, is here in his own personal capacity. We were talking about Scotland this week and the implications of the Scottish referendum and the recent rise of the SNP on the next general election, and of course, the country in general. And I was very pleased to be joined by Professor John Curtis from the University of Strathclyde. Those who know John will know that he's an expert on these matters and others, particularly Scotland, but also UK politics as well, and has written much on Scottish politics and the referendum and subsequent events. And we spoke for about 40 minutes this week, so we've split this episode into two parts. In the first part, we'll be talking about the referendum itself, perhaps why the Yes campaign was unable to win, and what the polling has shown since then, which of course, as most of us know, is a rise in vote shares for the SNP. What might that mean for Labour in the general election? And how worried should the Labour Party be, and how confident should the SNP be? And then in the second part of the podcast, which will be released in a few days, we will talk about looking towards the future and talking about the general election itself and what we think might happen. So I started today's this week's episode by asking John Curtis why he thought that the Scottish referendum was lost by the Yes side.
Well, the first thing, of course, you have to remember is that there was never a time during the whole 40 years during which this debate about Scotland's constitutional future has been taking place when the opinion polls had ever consistently reported that there was a majority in favour of independence. So the truth is, those who were arguing in favour of independence were always starting from behind. They recognised they were starting from behind, and that indeed it was always relatively unlikely that they were going to win. If they were going to win, the one thing they certainly needed to achieve was to try to persuade people in Scotland that independence would result in Scotland being economically better off, and perhaps individuals themselves, but more crucially, the wider idea that Scotland as a society would be economically more prosperous and financially sustainable. And the truth is that at the end of the day, they were not able to convince a plurality of people in Scotland that that was the case. Virtually every single opinion poll continued to report, when they were asking about this, that rather more people were pessimistic about the economic consequences of independence than were optimistic. And all the kind of number crunching one could do, this perception as to whether or not Scotland was or was not going to better off economic independence was the thing that seemed to be most clearly related to whether people were going to vote yes or no. I mean, there were other considerations, such as Scotland is a country where people feel a dual sense of identity, but where the sense of Scottish identity is stronger. That was always something that was primarily to the SNP's advantage, but because it was a society where many people do feel a sense of dual identity, therefore, in order to persuade people to go with their Scottishness rather than the Britishness, you needed to win the instrumental argument, particularly over economics, and they, in the end, weren't able to do so. That said, I think one has to say that most people recognise that in getting 45% of the vote, the Yes side actually did rather remarkably well. They have, as a result, ensured that the issue has not been put to bed, as was, I think, originally hoped for by the Unionist side when the Westminster government originally agreed to the referendum. And to that extent, at least, the debate in Scotland continues.
Absolutely. I mean, Rob, this is a polling-related podcast. Obviously, the polling caused quite a stir during the campaign. I mean, what did you make of the polling?
Well, I think the polling is in sort of the historical memory that seems to now be the received wisdom is sort of remembered in a particular way. I think the polling at the time was a lot more uncertain from a lot earlier in the stage of things than is perhaps remembered. People talk about one specific YouGov poll. I don't think that's necessarily the end of the story. I think there were lots of things that confirmed that. Some of the pollsters had the SNP doing, or sorry, rather the Yes campaign doing a lot better for a lot earlier on in things. And also, I think more broadly in the political debate, the uncertainties of what turnout was going to be and all those things meant that there was a lot more uncertainty about what was going to happen for a lot longer than I think is fair. I think the point that John just made is one of the most interesting ones, though, which is we now ask, so why didn't Yes win? I think the fact that they did so well is actually a much more interesting polling question in terms of getting that differential turnout, getting young people mobilised, in terms of making it much more of a change election, a wave election, making it about a lot more issues than just about independence, which certainly from the point of view of how you organise modern political campaigns is, I think, extremely interesting. And that ability to mobilise people, inspired in lots of ways by the Obama campaign, I think has a lot of instructive things to say about not just independence, but how we run political campaigns in the modern era.
I mean, John, one of the narrative that many sort of espouse at the moment is that one YouGov poll led to a panic and a promise of powers that perhaps hadn't been, you know, validated south of the border. I mean, do you buy that analysis? Do you think that YouGov poll really turned us from night and day in terms of that campaign?
Well, let's stand back slightly. I think the first thing that Rob kind of alluded to is that the truth is that for much of the campaign, on the one hand, all the opinion polls were saying the same thing, in the sense that until late August, early September, there wasn't a single opinion poll that suggested that the Yes side were ahead. But that said, there was, until late in the campaign, a persistent, consistent difference between the pollsters so far as the size of the No Lead was concerned, with, broadly speaking, three companies, TNSB, MRB, Ipsos, Mori, coming up with relatively low shares of the vote for the Yes side. In contrast, companies such as a panel base coming up with rather higher vote shares. That was just persistent. And we never really quite got to the bottom as to why that was the case. What then began to happen from about the middle of August onwards is that those polling companies, such as YouGov, such as Ipsos Mori, which had had relatively low shares of the vote for the No side, began to detect a fairly marked increase in support for the Yes side. The other companies, like panel based, like Savation, had a rather higher Yes vote historically, detected a bit of a swing, but rather small, and therefore, as a result, there was something remarkable, convergence. Yeah. So that's the first thing to bear in mind, is that it was only towards the end of the campaign that the polls converged. Now, I think the YouGov poll, almost the first rule of media reporting of opinion polls, is that the opinion poll, which is the exception, somehow peculiarly is taken as the rule and is somehow is typical of the polling of the period. And this, and the truth is, in this case, this is completely wrong. In fact, I mean, a number of points to make. The first is that, in fact, the YouGov poll that came up with 51% was actually part of a sequence of polls by that company, at least, which detected a movement from around the 41% mark a few weeks earlier through a series of polls to 51%. So the previous poll, 5 days earlier to that 51% poll, had the Yes side at 47%. That caused them a bit of a wobble on the markets. They were intriguingly taking much more notice of YouGov's polls than some of those polls that panel based observation had come up with earlier, which had already suggested that actually it was quite close. So, you know, markets decided to believe some companies more than others. But the second thing I think one then need to realise is that, in my view, that YouGov poll on its own was not the thing that absolutely told you something had changed. And it certainly wasn't the only poll to tell the story.
So when were you convinced something had changed?
Well, we were convinced of something, but there was another poll by TNSB MRB that was published 2 days after the YouGov poll, which, however, was available on embargo on the middle of the Monday. And that showed literally 50-50 split. It was very slightly no, I think, amongst the whole sample, and very slightly yes amongst those who were very likely to vote. And that, I think, is the poll that actually, for example, persuaded the Westminster politicians to abandon PMQs. That's what they knew on the Monday was coming up. In other words, at that point, you know, we could argue about whether Yes were ahead or not, but that meant another polling company, which had consistently suggested that the race was pretty much over, was now also saying it was a tight race. Okay, so therefore it wasn't just one poll, it was two polls, and I think that's the one that kind of said, okay, there's something to take notice of here, even though, of course, at the same time, for example, on the same day as the YouGov poll came out, a poll from panel base said, if I remember rightly, it was 48% yes, but again, people tended to ignore that. So, and then of course what one has to remember is this: if indeed, as looks to have been the case, that probably we were at something like 51-49, 52-48 for no at that stage in the campaign. The normal rules of stamping are at means that it's almost pretty darned inevitable that somebody at least is going to come up with a narrow lead. Right. And to that extent, at least, we shouldn't be surprised. Now, the other point that coming on specifically about, you know, the promise of the vow. I mean, actually, intriguingly, if you actually looked at the detail of that very same YouGov poll, what it showed was, as most polling had done, is that amongst those people whose first preference was more devolution, they were still voting between 5 and 6 to 1 on the no side. And that was what the polling of numbers is. In other words, actually, the no side didn't look as though they were having to do a great deal to appeal to those whose first preference was more devolution. What the YouGov poll suggested was that, as compared with a reading 2 or 3 months previously, is that in terms of first preferences, fewer people were now in favour of the constitutional status quo and more people were in favour of independence. And so therefore, to that extent at least, the issue that the no side needs to address is that actually, you know, independence has actually become rather more popular. So I'm not sure that the vow was necessarily the right response. I'm not necessarily sure that it was crucial. That said, what it did do was to deal with what I think, frankly, was a known strategic weakness on the no side throughout the campaign, which was, A, the unionist parties were relatively slow, at least certainly on the Labour and the Conservative side, in developing their ideas for more devolution, and they were deeply reluctant to come together and come up with an agreed vision, because what they all fancied doing was saying, well, no, actually, what we want to do is to put our plan in our manifesto in 2015. And what the panic did was eventually to persuade them that actually they did need to try to shore up their vote by actually coming up with a common plan. Now, the common plan came up afterwards more than before. The vow certainly, I think, did reflect, we can argue about whether it made a difference, but certainly given the shift in opinion, the decline in support for the constitutional status quo, this was a rare occasion, I think, when politicians' interpretation of what the vote meant as opposed to what it said, because the vote simply said we don't want independence, but the interpretation that actually the majority of people who voted no wanted more devolution, which was not necessarily true at the beginning of the campaign, was true by the end, and to that extent at least, that in that sense at least, politically more devolution made sense. But my view is they should have done it months earlier. Mm.
And of course that has dramatic implications for now. A lot of Labour's promise in Scotland, which might well have been sort of more devolution, the party that brought the original devolution settlement, now wants to take it to the next stage. In a sense, that's been taken away from them a lot.
Well, except I think what you need to bear in mind is that of the three unionist parties, the offer that Labour itself defined was the least devolutionary of the three. And one consequence of the vow process was primarily to drag the Labour Party in the direction of more devolution, not only on income tax, but also actually what the Smith Commission did, which was something that wasn't really there in any of the three original party proposals. It broke the principle that welfare, cash welfare benefits would not be devolved. They're not being very heavily devolved, but they are being devolved to a degree. And the truth is now, apart from macroeconomic management and the currency, it's difficult to say that there is any area of domestic policy over which the Scottish Parliament does at least have some say. And to that extent, at least, you know, we have ended up with something that's rather more than Labour were offering. And I think, you know, the truth is that Labour's plans in Gordon Brown's position on this is fascinating. I think it's very, very clear that back in March of the referendum, Gordon, aware of the concerns of his Westminster colleagues, rode back what the Devolution Commission for Labour would have said and dragged it away, for example, from the full devolution income tax, partly because of his concerns about how the Tories might react over the West Lothian question, but then realising where actually the campaign was going, then proved to be instrumental in pushing his party and pushing the whole of the unionist campaign in the other direction. It's an intriguing example of how somebody works out the way the political wind is blowing at different stages and moves his party to somewhere perhaps that it didn't really originally want to end up.
I mean, if we needed any evidence that the referendum was game-changing in the long term in terms of the political situation in Scotland, Perhaps we see that in the opinion polls that we've seen since the vote, and particularly in the recent past. Let's just read some numbers from polls in the last couple of weeks, and you know, the one that was released yesterday from Mori. Just looking at Labour and the SNP, so we've had panel base with a 10-point lead for the SNP, 41 to 31 over Labour. Servation, 46, SNP, 26 for Labour. And then yesterday, among those certain to vote, although to be honest, amongst voters in general, it wasn't much different, with Ipsos Mori, 52% with the SNP and 24% with Labour. There's clearly been a surge in support for the SNP in terms of Westminster voting, or at least that's what the polls are showing. Rob, what do you make of that?
Well, I think the interesting point there is the realignment, if you like, of a more solid SNP vote, which is consistently in favour of both independence and SNP for Holyrood and now Westminster. So I think you hit the nail on the head of the thing that's changed. But previously, we saw, obviously, Labour, I think, actually gain seats in 2010, whilst obviously having suffered a defeat, which was then repeated at Holyrood the following year. So I think that unwinding, if you like, of... people who, in a sense, at a national Holyrood level would vote SNP, but then vote Labour for Westminster is the most interesting point. But I think that to me suggests that there is the potential for some of that to unwind in terms of, as the election draws closer, potentially some of that support drifting back to Labour in terms of when the election and the media coverage becomes very much one of Labour versus the Tories in terms of who's going to form a government. And furthermore, I think the SNP have, to an extent, taken a particular sort of lever, if you like, out of their arsenal in terms of saying that they will not do any kind of deal with the Conservatives. I have a suspicion that there will be some people who walk into the ballot box going, do I vote for an SNP candidate to be in a coalition, or should I just vote for the real thing and vote for the Labour candidate? I mean, that's a hypothesis on my part. I'm not sure we're seeing very much of that in the numbers, but I have a suspicion that some of that will drift back to Labour as the election draws nearer.
So the theory goes, and this isn't, you're not the only person to say this, that actually, you know, as much as an opinion poll ever really is true, there'll be a significant amount of squeeze of whichever of these figures the SNP are on between now and the election.
Well, I think that would certainly be my hypothesis in terms of the way in which the media narrative and the polling and then the actual election draws nearer. That, you know, these are snapshots. And also, I think in fairness, when you're answering an opinion poll, particularly when there's a debate going on about this, exactly what the devolved powers are going to be, and the SNP are being very, very vociferous in terms of articulating what it is that they want to get out of it. Labour have a new leadership and are not necessarily 100% clear on their position on both the devolved, which devolved powers are going to be, or indeed what the English constitutional settlement will be in the future. It's not that surprising that the SNP are getting large amounts of support. The voters, I think, are extremely intelligent in terms of what it is that they want to communicate to the politicians that are making decisions, and it's quite clear that a strong SNP vote is a clear way of getting, in a sense, whipping the hand of the political elite to get them perhaps closer to what they want, which, as John has said, seems to be a lot more devolved powers than was the case 2 or 3 years ago.
I mean, John, there's a lot of polling out, and there's going to be, one imagines, between now and the election on specifically Scottish opinion on the Westminster vote. I mean, what's your take on these polls that we're seeing? We're seeing the three, the most recent that I mentioned, have a difference of 52% with Mori and 41% with panel base, but there's clearly some kind of surge there, isn't there?
Well, yes and no. The crucial thing that Rob has just said is that what's happened is that whereas until before the referendum, opinion polls consistently pointed to a higher Labour and a lower SNP vote for Westminster than for Holyrood, these two votes are now much more clearly aligned. That's the first thing to bear in mind. And that it's always been the case that when people in Scotland were focusing on Holyrood, the SNP had been strong. And that's been true from the very beginning of devolution. So that's point one. Second thing I would then say is just to point you to two figures and to realise how a very similar electoral performance produces very different consequences because the rules of the game are different. The SNP in 2011, the Scottish Parliament election, which was got them the overall majority at Holyrood, got 45% of the vote. The yes side in the referendum got 45% of the vote. On average at the moment, Ipsos Mori are a bit on the high side, but most of the opinion polls are pointing to 45% voting for the SNP. And so the reasons why I kind of disagree with Rob and disagree with a lot of skepticism on this, the first is disaster for Labour and electoral success for the SNP, and the winning by the SNP of constituencies that people say, oh, surely, possibly, it's impossible for the SNP to win, it's already happened. It happened 4 years ago in May 2011. And because now Westminster preferences have aligned with Holyrood preferences, that's one of the reasons why we're reflecting the situation. The second thing one needs to realise is that, ironically, the constitutional question as a result of the referendum now is more clearly related to the way in which people intend to vote in Scotland than has ever previously been the case. And that particularly for those on the yes side, they regard the referendum as another opportunity to express their faith in support for yes, and crucially, particularly, it's very clear that those people who said they voted for Labour in 2010 but voted yes in the referendum, the vast bulk of those are saying they're going to vote for the SNP, and they're voting on the constitutional question. Now here comes the crucial thing, and this is why I particularly disagree with Rob. You have to remember that for those people who voted yes in the referendum, to a fair degree, they don't care what colour of government it is at Westminster. They'd frankly prefer not to be governed by either government because they would prefer not to be part of the United Kingdom. And one piece of polling that was done, I think it was by Servation back in December, in which they asked people, you know, what are you voting on? Are you voting on the basis of, you know, Scottish issues, Scottish leaders, what's best for Scotland, or are you voting on British issues, British leaders? The people who are saying they're going to vote yes are saying they're voting on Scottish issues. The people who are voting no, they're voting for the SNP. The people who are voting for the Unionist parties are saying they're focusing on Britain. So therefore you need to realise that for the yes nationalist SNP vote, Westminster is in many respects irrelevant. And certainly it looks as though... The other thing to bear in mind is, again, another recent piece of polling evidence, is that over 40% of people, including over 40% of SNP voters, when you ask them, if you vote for the SNP, does that make it more likely or less likely that the Conservatives or the Labour Party in power, they say, I don't know. The complications of the electoral rhythmic of a hung parliament are, frankly, something that passes most voters by. And I think one just will simply say, you know, we heard this about UKIP. It was said, oh, it will all disappear following the European elections. It hasn't disappeared because there are too many UKIP voters who frankly do not care whether it's David Cameron or Ed Miliband that runs the country. And the truth is that certainly is true in spades for many people who are voting for the SNP. So the problem the Labour Party faces in a very short space of time is that it has to try to persuade people that the Westminster battle matters, and that it is a party worth supporting for. But herein then lies the real rub. The referendum was a brilliant two-year advertisement for the SNP. People in Scotland disagree about the merits of what the SNP stand for, but at least everybody in Scotland understands what it stands for, and there is widespread appreciation that actually, you know what, those guys who run the party and who run the government, they're rather good. They're rather good at their job. In contrast, the Labour Party, Scottish Labour Party went into the referendum with disagreeing about where it stood on fundamental devolved issues such as whether or not you do or do not charge for universal public services. It was involved in a no campaign that was inevitably primarily negative, and therefore it came out of that campaign many people not knowing what it stood for. And certainly now fundamentally challenged for the mantle of social justice. And then, of course, you also have the wider UK thing, which is that Jim Murphy's job would be a lot easier if indeed there was in London a UK Labour Party that people actually had a degree of enthusiasm for as the prospect of an alternative government. But frankly, that's not something that's been achieved either north or south of the border. So again, what are you selling people? So it's very, very difficult. Now, the one good piece of news for the Labour Party is that it doesn't have to recover all the way back to where it was in 2010 in order to be able to hang on to most of the seats. Because yes, indeed, it is true. Most of those seats that we're saying at the moment the SNP could win with, you know, 20-point leads or so are safe Labour constituencies. Mm-hmm. And that there are only three constituencies in this election where the SNP will start off less than 20 points behind, which almost exactly translates into, until the SNP are ahead of Labour, Labour hang on to most of what they've got. It's only once the SNP start to pull ahead of Labour that the seats go, though they then go very rapidly. And the number of seats the SNP gets is very, very sensitive to exactly how far they are ahead of Labour. So Labour's good. Bompi's good news for Labour is they've only got to get halfway back to where they were in 2010, and they'll hang on to most of their seats. But the job of getting halfway back against the backdrop of the legacy of the referendum and the weaknesses of both the Scottish and Labour Party that have been present there for, frankly, years, is a very substantial one.
That was part one of this week's two-part episode with John Curtis and Rob Vance talking about Scotland and the next general election. Join us in a couple of days for part two, where we'll be discussing the election itself and what we think might happen.